I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
Glad to be with you once again.
Everywhere you go, experts are telling you to borrow to improve your overall return with commercial property. And although for some of our listeners that may seem a rather fundamental issue, I thought it might be worth exploring this a little more during our time together today. To start with, how or why does borrowing enhance the return you can achieve from your investment property?
Well, Ken, I think this goes to the nub of why people borrow money. And you may have often heard it referred to as leverage. And the reason for that is that when you borrow, you are able to control more property with the same amount of equity or cash that you contribute to the purchase. Maybe the simplest way would be for me to give you an example, and I'll keep the figures simple just so that we can illustrate the point. But let's suppose you had $100,000 to invest. Now, you could buy a small office suite for that, and let's assume that your return or your capital growth for the year would be 10%. Now, it's obviously not going to be that high. It's probably going to be closer to 5 or 6. But for the purpose of the exercise, to understand how leverage works, let's assume that. So you purchased the property for $100,000, and at the end of the first year, you had a 10% growth. Now, that means that your increase in value is $10,000. Now, that's not a typical calculation. Properties were now worth $110,000, but your growth component is $10,000. Now, let's suppose instead of paying cash outright for the property, you decide that you're going to borrow 50%. And so with that same $100,000, you could then purchase a property worth $200,000. Now, again, the market would deliver you the same 10% growth, but this time on two properties. So instead of your capital growth being at the end of 12 months $10,000, it's now $20,000. So you think, well, this is a good thing. Let's extend it a bit further. And let's, instead of borrowing 50%, let's borrow 75%. So that means for the same $100,000, you can now control four properties worth $400,000, and you still receive from the market the same 10% capital growth on each one. So at the end of the 12-month period, instead of just being a $10,000 increase in value, you now enjoy a $40,000 increase in value. So this is the reason why people borrow, is so that with sometimes a limited amount of equity, they can leverage up, magnify the capital growth that they can receive from the same amount of equity. So in other words, on that third example where you're borrowing 75% on your equity of $100,000, you are effectively getting a $40,000 increase in capital growth. So therefore, you're getting a 40% return capital-wise on that $100,000 instead of the $10,000 or 10% return on the single property being owned. Now, of course, you need to factor in things like the interest on the funds that you're going to borrow. But then that has the advantage that that's tax deductible. And so therefore, the income return, the annual return provided in rent by the property, you can shield part of that from the tax department by deducting the cost of interest. Now, if in the third example your interest exceeds the amount of income, that's what's called negative gearing, and therefore you can claim that against your personal income and get a further deduction. And in addition to that, you are able to claim depreciation of the plant and articles, as they're called, within the property itself, as well as, of course, the structural component, but that's only at 2.5%. The beauty with depreciation is that while it is a deduction, it's a non-cash deduction. In other words, it doesn't come out of your pocket, but it serves to lower your taxable income. So even if you didn't borrow so much money that the interest exceeded the income from the property, you could still end up effectively negatively geared, as it were. In other words, you can have deductions greater than the income by the use of depreciation. So hopefully that gives you a quick overview, and while it might be a bit fundamental, sometimes it doesn't hurt just to revisit these things from time to time.
So now that we've established that, just how much should you actually be borrowing?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. Difficult in the sense that it is a very personal question as far as each individual investor is concerned. The simple test I give people that I work with is that you need to establish what I call your threshold of insomnia. In other words, you only borrow as much till you reach the point where it is causing you to lose sleep at night. Now, for some people, that's 30%. Other people, 50%. Some people don't mind not only borrowing the maximum on the property, but actually borrowing against another property to release some equity and then put that into the next property they purchase. So effectively, it ends up being 100% borrowed or geared. So it's not an easy answer. So you just need to think it through. And, you know, when you're starting out, quite often people will borrow to the max. As I said, they might get a line of credit on their home and then go and borrow 70% on the property they're purchasing. And so they actually effectively have no cash in the investment property. And because they have a high income and therefore claim the negative gearing against the income, it serves their purpose. That's fine. You know, there are obviously some risks in doing that. If, you know, what if the tenant leaves? You've still got to pay the mortgage payments. If you've got income to cover that outside of the property, that's not an issue. But they're things that you need to consider and just, you know, think that through from a personal point of view and take advice. I mean, sit down with your accountant or your financial planner and just talk through what you're comfortable with. Even if you do want to borrow to the max on the property, which, as I said, generally with commercial, it's about 70%. One of the things to help you gain comfort would be that you place into an interest-bearing account 3 months' interest payments on the mortgage, so that if, for whatever reason, the tenant didn't pay that month, for whatever reason, it might be legitimate. It might be Christmas time or the financial accountant is ill that particular month, whatever the reason. So long as you have sufficient coverage that it's not going to cause you a hiccup if, for whatever reason, for 1 or 2 months, the tenant doesn't actually pay you the rent. I mean, they may end up paying you in 2 months' time, so you get back up to date. But I'm just saying, you can at least take some steps to address that. But what I find, which is interesting, well, once people establish their portfolio, in other words, get two or more properties, they rarely gear themselves more than 65% on a loan-to-valuation ratio. And the reason for that is that they treasure the free cash flow that they have. And as I said, with depreciation, you can protect that. You don't necessarily have to gear up to protect it from the tax department I'm talking about. And it also means that they're not vulnerable to sharp rises in interest rates if you've chosen to run with a variable rate rather than a fixed rate. And their philosophy is that they buy properties that they have no intention of selling. Now, I know I insist with my clients that they have a four-year mandatory review and have to justify holding the property, but that's really so you don't get complacent. But if you buy the property right with the right tenant, with the right flexibility of design, meeting all those investment criteria that we've discussed earlier, there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to hold it and refinance it down the track. You release, not borrowing anymore as a percentage, but release part of the growth that you've gained over the period to then go and extend your portfolio. And the beauty with that is that that tends to step around capital gains tax, because it's the continual buying and selling of property that causes issues. Now, if you structure yourself properly, you should be able to get a 50% credit on the capital gain so that you don't have a total exposure. So, you know, capital growth is not taxed as heavily if you're structured properly. But all I'm saying is that you just need to think through what works for you, and part of that is talking it through with your advisors so that you feel comfortable, you're not exposing yourself, but equally you're not paying to the tax department any more than you need to in the process.
And what steps can you take to minimise any risks involved?
Look, every investment you make, whether it's residential, commercial, shares, buying collectibles, all have their own inherent risks. And it's important that you set out to minimise those. And I know in an earlier podcast we talked about taking sensible risks or controlled risks and mitigating what your potential downside can be. But as far as commercial property is concerned, obviously the first thing you need to do is to make sure that you haven't paid too much. And you recall in the nine-step formula that the finance component falls into two parts. The initial part being that you get a guide from a valuer up to the maximum that they would support. So in other words, you know when going for the finance that what you've paid is going to match the valuation, and therefore you can very easily establish your loan to valuation ratio. Obviously, the next step in that process is to control the valuation, and that's where you instruct the valuer and you own the valuation, and you don't pass it across to, when I say pass it, you don't assign it, but you certainly give them a copy, but it's in your name, to the various finance sources. You don't assign it to them until you have the deal that you want. So that removes the surprises and any of the unknown things that sometimes the banks can throw up, so that you can step around that and don't find yourself exposed at the last minute to something that you hadn't factored into your calculations. Obviously, when you're signing guarantees, you make sure that you don't sign joint and several guarantees, particularly if you're purchasing a property in partnership with someone. And a joint and several guarantee means that not only are you responsible for your part of the loan or your proportion of the loan, if the other party or parties can't meet their obligations, the financier can have recourse to you. And so that's something you need to watch out for and take advice. And this is where your team of consultants come in to advise you on that, both from a mortgage broker's point of view and the legal side. So what I would do in most cases, particularly if you are a conservative borrower, is to take out what's called a non-recourse loan. And generally, that's part of the reason why most professional, and professional doesn't mean huge investor. I just meant someone that has more than two or three properties. That's why they tend to limit the borrowing to around 65%, because at that level, the financier will look to the property as the sole security for the loan. They don't require personal guarantees of you or the directors of the company or unit trust or whatever it is that's buying the property. So you should always, in my view, once you get established, is to seek out and convert your funding to non-recourse finance. Obviously, you talk about minimising risks. When you look at the lease on the property, always make sure that you have a good bond, or more particularly security deposit, or they call bank guarantees. And so for the smaller properties, that might be around 3 months rent. But as it gets a little larger and the leases get longer, more often it's up around 6 months. If you're lucky, you get 12-month bank guarantee. And that means if the tenant defaults, you not only can you cover rent, but you can cover the releasing costs and any of those expenses involved there. And the last one is just make sure that the building itself is covered from an insurance point of view, fully covered for replacement cost. Don't go for indemnity insurance, go for replacement cost, and also for loss of income. Now, with a body corporate, that covers the structure, but you still need what's affectionately called top-up insurance to cover things like the carpet and the light fittings, which are internal to the property and not the structure which the body corporate looks after. So hopefully that just gives you a quick overview of how to minimise any risks involved.
You mentioned depreciation benefits earlier. How do you factor those into your calculations?
Yeah, look, I did mention depreciation. I don't want to go into it in depth here because I think we have probably covered on an earlier podcast. But, you know, depreciation's an amazing thing because you can depreciate things like carpets, the security system and data and communication and things like that at 40% per annum on a diminishing value basis. And then it drops back to things like dishwashers and signage at around 20% and your air conditioning package units around 13%, but there's a whole lot of other things that, as I said, you get a quantity surveyor to prepare a schedule and you can claim them as legitimately as a tax deduction to shield your income so it doesn't come out of your pocket, the deduction, but it does reduce your taxable income. So it's certainly something that you need to consider once you've bought the property.
Would you like to recap on what we've just covered?
Okay, some sort of general financing principles. Number one would be to get the best loan possible over each property and create the capacity when doing so to allow you to move quickly on any new opportunities. This is where you get a finance broker involved. As I said, once you get established, if you limit your borrowing to 65%, it frees you up. It gives you flexibility to move quickly. The main thing is that you focus on the asset first and then you make your decisions as far as financing is concerned. Also, and if this is where, again, a finance broker can help you with looking at non-bank sources, because they're not borrowing money and then on lending it, it's funds that they have available and their interest rates are generally low and they're quite often more flexible in the way they package a deal. And also an important thing is to seek out a funder where they don't require yearly reviews, and that's costly and it's intrusive. So another thing is don't just have a single lender for every property you've got. You've got to ensure that also that you offer the minimum security to the funder. You don't want to allow yourself to have cross-collateralization where they tie up different properties. It just makes it difficult for you to move down the track. So I said, give only the security that's required, not everything that's available, just to keep them happy. That's part of the reason you get the valuation, so that you control the thing right through to settlement. And I would prefer that you don't use your own residence as security as a line of credit, unless it's absolutely necessary. And as I said, it's starting out, it might be, but as soon as you can, remove the house from the funding arrangements. So hopefully, Ken, that gives you a few tips and a wrap up on the aspect of finance.
I do hope you don't mind my asking you about this today, but I know I personally found it most helpful.
And I trust our listeners did too.
Ah, I'm sure they would have. Look, thank you for making everything clear.